had context for me, they would have been able to make that group of judgments that we all know Indian in-laws like to make about
the person. You like to categorize. I'm really excited to introduce our guest today. Her name is Leah Frankie. She is a best-selling author. If you haven't read it already, she has written this brilliant book called America for Beginners. It's about family, immigration, prejudice, and the American dream. So if you need a quarantine read, this is where I'd go. Let's start from the beginning. Could you tell us about yourself a little bit, the whole story, where you come from, how and why did India happen, all that good stuff?
Absolutely. Yeah, so I come from Philadelphia originally, so that's why I'm back here now. After college, I came back to Philadelphia and worked for a while in Philadelphia theater, and I applied to NYU's dramatic writing program, which is a master's program that teaches you dramatic writing, so like playwriting, TV writing, screenwriting. Mm-hmm. And I attended that program where I met my now husband, who is originally from India. He's from Calcutta, actually. Yeah. And he was making a big career shift from derivatives trader to screenwriter. Mm-hmm. And we got together, we got married, and we decided to move to India, where he wanted to be working in Bollywood and in Indian media.
Yeah.
During that period, before we moved, I started working on a novel, which was a really new form for me. My background and my master's were in dramatic writing, and then doing fiction was new, but I'm a really avid fiction lover. I mean, and I've trained in other ways to write, and this story, America for Beginners, just seemed like a more of a novel than anything else.
Yeah.
That's what brought me to India, and I've been living in India for almost 5 years. The book was inspired primarily at first by the tour that my in-laws took of the United States when they came for our coming to see Rohan graduate. I think at that point we were already together. We already knew we were going to get married. I think they're like, okay, we'll meet this foreign, this gory, that's I'm wearing, Gora. Yeah. I guess it's gory. I'm female. We'll meet this foreigner, we'll do this stuff. And my in-laws hadn't gotten many opportunities to travel outside of India before that period. So they thought they'd combine it because they had not been to the United States before, and everybody they know had done a tour like this when they'd gone to the US, and it was like, oh, that's what we'll do.
Yeah.
And my husband accompanied them on that tour. He had a terrible experience. He hated it very much. I don't even know that my in-laws had that great of experience. They were sort of like, why does everybody do this? And that really inspired me, their experience, the way that they approached the United States. It really inspired me, and it really was very different than my own heritage, which is immigrants and migrants, but of different generations. And the way, the sort of immigrant narrative and the coming to America narrative that I'd been a part of was very different than my husband or my in-laws. And I think all that together inspired the first draft of the novel. And I had done a lot of drafts before I moved to India. I just think India really deepened it, because as much as you can understand by, you know, living with an Indian person, we're doing a lot of research, asking a lot of questions, reading a lot of Indian literature, texting your mother-in-law, you learn a lot more when you are immersed in the country. I think the mindset of a country and the way it shapes people is something that you experience better and faster if you are there.
Right. So, I mean, I'm just a little curious, because you mentioned your future in-laws coming right after you guys graduated. What was that like? Was that your first meeting with your Indian in-laws, essentially? What was that like?
It was really interesting. I mean, we already knew that Rohan and I had already decided that we were going to get married. So I knew the relationship was serious, I guess.
How long have you guys been dating?
We had been dating at that point for about 9 months. We'd known each other for, I guess we met in the fall of 2012, which is when our grad program started. So I'd known him for about a year before we started. I'd known about like 10 months, 9 months before we started dating. And then we were together over the course of like our second year of graduate school. So really not that long from my perspective. But we got serious pretty fast. And part of why we got serious is that I mean, we really love each other and we loved each other then, but I think that my husband already knew he wanted to go back to India, and I was open to that. And I think for him, that was like, this is somebody I could see a future with, because it's somebody who is willing to live in India for a period of time, you know, willing to sort of do that. And I was, you know, I met my in-laws. I mean, it wasn't like a lot of, you know, sometimes you meet somebody's boyfriend or girlfriend, you're like, I don't know how long this is going to stick around. Like, I knew I was going to be in it.
It was a real deal. Yeah.
Ron and I worked it out.
Yeah.
And I think my in-laws knew that too. They were really, really nervous to meet me. I was really nervous to meet them. I don't think that my husband internalized how nervous they were. I think they felt really totally at sea. I mean, if I had been Indian, they would have had context for me. They would have been able to make that group of judgments that we all know Indian in-laws like to make about person.
You like to categorize.
Even if I'd been an NRI, I still would have had an Indian surname, and they would have been like, oh, she's from Kerala, that means she's like this, you know. And they could have been, and often aren't, totally wrong, but they would have had the security of knowing or thinking they knew something about me.
Right.
I think that being an American, it was just like, I'm Jewish. My dad's from Puerto Rico. My mom's family is originally from sort of Russia, sort of Borscht Belt. So I'm half Russian Jewish, half Puerto Rican. None of that had any meaning for my in-laws. You know, like none of those words meant.
They didn't really fulfill any criteria, right? So, I mean.
I fulfilled that criteria. They did not know anything about either of those things. So I think they were like, what do we do with this person? I think some relative or somebody they knew at some point in the past had married a girl from Texas named Mandy. And she was like a tall, leggy blonde. This is for listeners. So like, I'm like a short, you know, swarthy Jewish person.
Uh-huh.
But she was like a tall, leggy blonde. And I think they were like really freaked out that, you know, they were going to, you know, like that Rohan, my husband, was going to be with some like Playboy bunny. Like they just didn't, you know, they just didn't know anything about, they just didn't have any context
yeah.
for me.
Yeah.
So I think when I first met them, it was very fun. It's a very like funny incident. Like I went to their Airbnb where they were staying, and I brought food, and my sister-in-law was also with them. My future sister-in-law was also with them. She was like making dinner, and my mother-in-law, they were so tired. Like they had just gotten off the plane, but they wanted to get it over with. You know, they wanted to meet me and get it over with. Right. They're super jet lagged.
Did you have any kind of context whatsoever before you went to India this time that, okay, this is what I'm going to expect. This is what my life over there is going to be like. This is what kind of work I'm going to be doing. Did you have anything planned at all? Or was it just take it as it comes?
I had never been to India before I moved to India. So that was an interesting thing to do with my life. In some ways, I'm kind of glad because I think that India is overwhelming. And I think that there's things that are very specifically overwhelming for me about India. And if I visited, I might've gotten too freaked out. I actually think that like coming and having to be there in for the benefit to get past a lot of the things that like, were the initial sort of shockers or the initial difficulties.
Yeah.
Because actually I think that, the more I live in India, like the more I understand it, the more I am able to navigate India. We're also lucky to live in Mumbai, which is like a really wonderful city, incredibly, you know, compared to all the rest of India, really cosmopolitan, really international, really accessible. Accessible for Indians. It's like the most digital city. It's the most easy to navigate city, I think. I mean, it's a tough city in terms of, you know, its geography and whatever, but like, it's just so much easier to get things done. There's so much that's accessible to you. So I was lucky in that. Mm-hmm. But I think that the thing that really contextualized it best for me was talking to my husband about it. But he also kind of had not misconceptions, but he had his own set of like things he wasn't sure about, because Rohan had at that point lived outside of India for like 12 years.
Sure.
So he'd been back, but he'd like been back to Calcutta, you know, staying with his parents is a really different thing. And he never lived alone as an adult in India. And that was also kind of good for us because we were doing it together. Like there were a lot of questions we had together. It wasn't like he was an expert and I was a total novice. He speaks Hindi, he knows the country, but there were a lot of things that we had to try to figure out together. And I think that was a good thing for us. It like allowed us to be explorers together.
Yeah, it's always fun.
But it was totally overwhelming. And there were. I think that I got a lot of misconceptions about living in India, and I got a lot of bad advice from a lot of people.
Oh,
I got a lot of very fearful advice from Indians. I've often laughed with other expat friends about how bad the advice is to get published.
Yeah, I don't think like, Lonely Planet's the way to go about India. I mean, that is not should not be anybody's go-to when moving to India.
No, and Shantaram like is not a good guide.
No,
books about India are not good guides. You know, I think it really does depend what city you live in. It really does depend on how much, you know, sort of what you're doing. There were so many things that, like, neither of us were sure about. Like, I have a very vivid memory that my first weekend, I ventured out on my own for the first time. The rains were still happening at the very end of August. It was mid-September, so there was like a tail end of the rains. And I was like walking in my rain shoes, and I went to Santa Cruz Market. We live very close to Santa Cruz train station. So I went to Santa Cruz Market, and I just like bought some bananas. Like I didn't even need anything. I was just sort of like, what is anything?
You just want to get out of the house.
And I went back, and Rohan was like, so how much did they charge you? And I told him, and they were like, oh, okay, great. Because he was like, I don't know if you're going to be charged more. Like, there are so many questions. I did not have to pay a skin tax for my bananas. We were both glad about that.
Okay. That's always a relief.
Yeah. The thing that was the most true and positive thing that I did sort of take heart in was, like, everybody who had lived in Mumbai was like, it is a great city for women. Yeah. And I was like, I'm going to trust that. But I didn't know if I'd have to dress differently. Like, I had so many questions that only living there answered.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, as much as people can give you advice for moving, before you move anywhere, I think we all do have our own realities. And then we also have to sort of take our own journey and then create that reality for ourselves, I think, right?
Like, cities make me feel safe. I mean, now, you know, COVID, other people make us feel dangerous, but make us feel unsafe.
Yeah.
But usually, and I think, again, once this, you know, hopefully sort of passes, people make me feel safe as a woman. Like, having people around makes me feel safe.
Yeah.
And Mumbai feels safe.
There's always people around. It's literally the city that never sleeps, essentially. So I think, yes,
yeah,
definitely.
I mean, and women come from all over India to live in Mumbai because it feels safe.
Because it is safe.
So it's like,
hands
that
down.
Was, I think, the one thing that everybody told me that was the truest thing that I knew. And that later when I visited other Indian cities, it made me appreciate Mumbai even more because I did not necessarily always feel that way. I still don't. So.
Right. No, and I absolutely agree with that statement. I mean, I think most people feel the same way. It's a very safe place. People are super friendly and ready to help. And even if it's 3 o'clock in the morning, you know you can get an auto from one street over and you can head over to a restaurant on your own and you really face no problem whatsoever. So I definitely think that's pretty awesome about Bombay and very unique to it. What I'm curious about is that, you know, as an author, you probably are able to see and note the subtleties of and traits of society that I think a lot of us aren't sometimes, have that kind of exposure or able to see. So, I mean, is there anything in particular that stood out to you?
You know, some of the most sort of painful, beautiful, strange observations I've heard about my own country or my own context have come from people who are visiting it, right? Because they see differently. And I would say, yes, definitely being a writer, being an artist, you know, sort of being a writer is, I think, definitely for most of us, like being an observer of human nature, at least trying to observe human nature.
Yeah.
Like a psychologist, but with more narrative, you know, with more imagination and less probably objective truth. I think that, you know, one of the big things that's been tough in moving to India is the concept of labor and like positioning socially and how people interact with that. And I think that's got into a bigger thing of my realizing that like a lot of the things that you think that I thought I had a complacency about being universal, like concepts of politeness or concepts of respect, they are incredibly culturally subjective. And I think that that is something that's very visible to me in India, because, you know, that while there is no one collective West, there is more, you know, I understand Europe or Europeans more intuitively than I might understand Indians, because there's just more of a cultural resonance, though of course there's tons of cultural differences. And I just, that just, you know, it just, that's something that I think is something that I observe over and over again that continually kind of jars me. Because I don't know if it'll ever feel normal. And I don't know if I want it to feel normal because it's so different. Like the way people treat each other, I think, is a difference. And that doesn't mean that there's less love and care and consideration or that there's more love and care and consideration somewhere else. It's just such a fundamental way of being and a fundamental different expectation. I've definitely had people who didn't take me seriously until I yelled at them, and didn't take yelling negatively, you know, like people in my home who didn't do a job and like did not take, you know, my way of relating to them, which I thought was like kind and respectful and whatever, was like totally uncomfortable for them. And like, totally like, what are you doing? What, you know? So I don't know. It's sort of a complex answer, but I think kind of a complex question. So.
No, definitely. Could you give me an example for maybe like a work setting, something of that nature? You maybe.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Well, I think like the idea. Oh, here's a good example. I used to work for this office where it. First of all, like we had an office boy, which was really weird. Like, I don't think you've had an office boy in the United States since like the, you know, I don't even think like 1960s America. Like you had an office boy. Like
even that feels very. Like, I don't think they could get called office boy. So that's a thing.
Yeah, I just think that maybe the title, it's like an office administrator, office assistant. Maybe they have an office boy whose like main job is to bring tea. It's just like a very different thing. Yeah. So like we had this, like we had like a sink area and a microwave. People had their lunch at the office. And we had, sort of china. Like we had like, you know, porcelain dishes, like not fancy stuff, but just like reusable plates. And so, you know, people just would leave their dishes in the sink and then somebody would come, or I think the office boy at the end of the day would clean it. So at one point he was sick and people just kept leaving dishes in the sink. And then there was an announcement like, please use paper dishes, you know, because he's sick. I was like, why don't we just do our own dishes? And like, just wash your own dish, like then, you know, just to me, it seems, and people looked at me like that was incredibly insane, you know, and they were just like, well, why would we do that? We have an office boy. And it was just like such a difference of like, that's what that person is here for. And my bosses were American and they always thanked him when he brought tea or coffee or whatever. I don't know that anybody else ever did. Like, I don't know that I ever saw, I mean, any European that we had at the company, any non-Indian, even if they were NRIs, always, like, always thanked him. I don't know that I ever saw an Indian client thanking him for coffee.
Right.
Or tea. It was a very mixed company, very international company. And I did notice that, like, my Indian colleagues thought it was, I could see that they thought it was strange that we thanked the office boy, which doesn't mean that he went unacknowledged or that he expected, like, I'm not making a comment like, oh, they're cruel and we're wonderful. It was just such a different relationship to like what this social interaction is like. And once when I was talking to my Hindi teacher, I was talking to her about thank you. And she's like, yeah, but it would just be so much work for me to thank the grocer every time I bought something. Like, that's so much work. I have to remember to do it.
It's so inefficient.
Well, for me, it's intuitive. And I said it would be more work for me not to thank the grocer. I don't have to think about it. It's like, it's an automatic, but I thank people for everything.
Yeah.
A Korean colleague was like, wow, you're so American. You keep thanking. I'm like, well, it's just very ingrained in like,
it's very ingrained
the interaction.
Yeah. No, I think that's definitely something that a lot of us have experienced. And me personally as well, a lot of my other friends who moved to Mumbai, was that I think the way we've been raised, or at least in school, the way we've been drilled is to be excessively polite when compared to the interactions in India. We do a lot of please and thank yous. Like, I remember, I mean, I'm getting off in the auto and I'm thanking my auto driver and he's looking at me like I'm crazy. I mean, this is unnecessary. I'm thanking the Lyft man for opening the door for me and he's looking at me like I'm crazy. I mean, not to say that other people not saying please and thank you is, I mean, there's anything wrong with that. It's just they're acknowledging him in another way, which he's maybe more used to.
Exactly.
You know, he's still happy.
It's what we have understood to be polite.
Yeah.
And the concept of politeness, the very concept of politeness is culturally, is just culturally different. And I think it's like, it's just the way that we've understood this interaction is supposed to be. And I think the same with family. Like, I always thank my sister-in-law, and she once was like, why are you being so formal? Like, she's annoyed with me. She's like, why are you being so formal with me? And I was like, well, because this is the way that I am with everyone. And by the way, this is what I would like in return. I wish you thanked me more, you know, like, and I think that there's this idea that intimacy, you know, like politeness is culturally and linguistically programmed, and it is a very different way to be polite culture by culture. And you can realize that in theory, but the reality of it in practice is like sometimes a little jar, I think.
You know, absolutely. And I mean, just because you brought up a sister-in-law, and I'm just wondering, I mean, so did you feel that there were different expectations set on you compared to your sister-in-law, who is in fact Indian and brought up in India?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm am really, really lucky. As I said, my in-laws are wonderful. My sister-in-law, my brother-in-law, my husband has two siblings. Both my sister-in-law and my brother-in-law are wonderful, incredibly, like, instantly really accepting, to the point that I was a little like, this is too much. Like they were like, we are family now. And I was like, I don't really know you people. Like, we met for the first time. You know, like, I needed more time to feel like family. And I'm so lucky that they are so wonderful, accepting, like, as a matter of course, like, wonderful. But I do think that there was a different expectation for me. And I think part of that is that my in-laws are, they live in Calcutta, but they're actually Punjabi. And the Punjabis in Calcutta are a very small community. It's not a traditional place for Punjabis to end up. Mm-hmm. And my sister-in-law is not only Indian, but she's also a Punjabi from Calcutta. And I think that they just had this idea that because she's their same group, that she would understand everything about their family and she would be like them. And I've seen that a lot with people who, you know, marry within their sort of cultural community anywhere in the world, date in that, is that you have this expectation that because we have these similarities, everything will also be the same. I think people are a lot kinder and more understanding when the difference is more visible. Yeah. And they all just be much, they're more willing to do the work. And so I think that I've been given incredible sort of leniency, and like, I'm praised for anything they do right, and I'm forgiven everything I do wrong. And like, there's a lot of like, well, she's foreign, so she's like that, she's like that only. my in-laws are, you know, wonderful to all of us. They're wonderful to my sister-in-law, but I feel bad. I think that everybody gives me a lot more of a like free pass.
Sure.
Just on stuff that, like, I just don't think that, I don't think if I was Indian, I would get such a free pass.
Sure. You also feel that, I mean, because a lot of people have spoken about this quite openly now, the concept of being a white person living in Bombay, do you feel like there is such a thing as white privilege living in Bombay?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I do. And I think that it would be, and I know from the news, from it's pretty visible that it is very different. It would be very different if I was, say, African-American. Like, having darker skin is not of an advantage. And definitely there's like a perception around. I definitely think there's white privilege. I mean, I think that, call it post-colonial hangover, call it fairness obsession. First of all, like, we're more visible because they're, even though they're like 50,000 expats, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Mumbai, it's a city of like 25 million people. So like, sure, we're rare. We're like a rare unicorn, you know? We're like white magic, whatever. And I think that, especially if you're from like a desirable country, right? Like, I'm from the United States. That's an aspirational place. So there's something like great. People love that. The U.S. is still very, like, you know, regardless of what it actually is, there's this idea of, like, you know, moving to America, America's a place for success or whatever. And you, I know, have talked about, like, we've talked about how, you know, you are Indian, but you're really Belgian.
Yeah.
But people have an expectation that you would understand.
Yeah, I should understand.
Even though you are, like,
exactly,
you know, you're European. Like, why would you understand? But, like, because you look Indian, you are Indian, you should get it. And they never do that to me. There's an incredible privilege. Like, you know, you get a lot of, like, I don't know, I think there's, like, a delight some people have in, like, like, white people doing Indian things. Like, people love it when you're a sari. People love it when you, you know, anything you do, people just sort of love it. And I think that it just, you're excused a lot. Like, within my family, I think it's the same. Like, I'm excused a lot. People delight if you know anything about India.
Yeah.
And they, and they forgive you so much if you do not. I do think that that's certainly like a Mumbai thing. I mean, I could be other cities. I think it's not the opposite. I mean, you projected a little bit, I think, but it does, it's not as great when I'm traveling, especially in the north, because I definitely think people try to screw you more. You know, I definitely think
you get ripped
your
off
disability and... is like, yeah. Like, yeah, when, especially in like North India, because there's,
the triangle and tourist hub, definitely, I think over there you do have a
tendency. Exactly, yeah. I mean, it can be a little bit like a party trick, like, you're just special, you know, as a white person, you're special.
Yeah, exactly. You're special. I mean, we've seen it, we've spoken about it, and it's definitely true, right? I think to a very large degree, when, I keep saying white people, I don't know if this is politically correct, but in this conversation, I mean, as a white person, I feel like even if you fill the basic criteria, you're given a big round of applause. And then you're an
Absolutely.
expat who maybe is, looks very much Indian. It's almost like, well, you need to be able to even address the subtle complexities of Indian society, and how dare you not understand this?
Absolutely. No, it's like if you're a white person, you eat something slightly spicy, they're like, oh my God, you're amazing. I'm like, you're an Indian girl and you don't like, you're not, you're like, sorry, it's slightly crooked. And they're like, you have brought shame on us all. You know, like it's really extreme.
No, totally, totally. And I mean, do you have any idea why you think that is? I mean, is it actually colonial hangover, or is it a fair, lovely complex? Like, what is it?
Fairness obsession did not begin with the British. You know, like I think cultures and like all that says is pretty historic, right? Because it can't just begin with the British. What about places like China that like weren't colonized but still have a fairness obsession? You know, it's like fairness as a thing is a sort of an iconic historic beyond any one colonizer. I think there is in some way a colonial hangover because I do think that like. For example, I mean, I think that there's definitely a colonial hangover in the prizing of English as a language, right? The fact that it's still like really important and a mark of education and a mark of sophistication and like and for privilege, I think has to be colonial hangover because I think that you know there's no other reason why English would be so important, except within the last you know sort of 20 years as a global business language. Like other countries, they have you know English is a language that is useful and people enjoy, not in the same sort of reverence for English that I think that India really had, and then other post you know sort of post-colonial. Post-colonial nations also have. So I think that comes sort of comparison there. But I don't, you know, as to like why white people are so delightful for so many years, maybe, I mean, it could be this sort of aspiration of the fact that like it was governed by this small of white people who were powerful and sort of all was directed towards their superiority in order to govern India. So maybe that sort of superiority lingers. But I don't know, it could also just, I think it could also be representation in media, right? That like, even though India makes so much of its own content, the sort of content influx of the 90s, like the 80s and 90s of sort of Western
Western
media
media, yeah.
might also enforce that, right? That like, I don't know. I mean, I wish I knew. I can't say that it has never benefited me because of course it has, but then it also comes with a lot of white guilt because you're like, oh God, I'm like participating and you know, like it's always the days of the Raj and you're like, oh, this should not be the case, but I'm so happy you get me a seat on the train. Sort of
Especially when you're with your brown expat friends and they do not get the same treatment.
exactly. You're just like, oh, this is so
I'm
uncomfortable.
sorry.
You know, like, and also negative. Like, it's not just my discomfort. It's also like, you know, you should either like treat everybody well or treat nobody well. But you know, but yeah, I think that it's just, I could not. I guess maybe an anthropologist could better point directly, like
Yeah.
why.
Which brings me to my final sort of question and final area of what I wanted to cover. So what are your sort of, key takeaways then from your 5-year experience in India, besides a phenomenal novel?
Oh yeah. Well, two of my new novels coming out of my new novel set in Mumbai, so hopefully that's also phenomenal.
Well, tell
Let's
me
see if
about
people
that.
think
What's it
that.
called?
Oh, my new novel is called Motherland. It comes out July 14th, and it's about a woman who moves to India with her Indian husband, an American woman who moves to India with her Indian husband, and she's not an NRI. She's a white American lady like me, and her mother-in-law decides to leave her father-in-law and comes and moves in with them. So you know, you tell that plot to Westerners, and they're like, "Oh, that's a nightmare." And you tell that plot to Indians, and they're like, "Well, then what happens?" And you're like, "Oh, okay." Yes, I think, I mean, there's so many things that I take away from my time in India. Like it's given me incredible context for my husband and his family that I just don't know that I could have gotten. I'm sure I would have gotten it eventually, but it sort of shortened the process of figuring out Indian families specifically, in a really firsthand way. I mean, I think that you can absolutely learn a lot about a place never having lived there, but living there just gives you a big jump, you know, like it just seeing things in context gives me a big jump. I think there's a lot of things that I was very judgmental about before I moved to India, that seeing them in their context, it didn't change necessarily my judgment. I still have the same sort of moral sentiment, but I have a lot more empathy because I think that things are so much more complicated from the inside out. And I definitely think that, you know, some of the ways, like the pressures on people, the pressures on relationships, the ways that people treat each other are very informed by their environment. So while I might, I was much more quick to sort of judge, a husband not standing up for his wife to his parents, or somebody, you know, not marrying the person they love because of cultural or religious differences. I was very quick to, you know, say that's horrible, that's wrong. Mm-hmm. And I still don't think it's great, but I'm able to sort of see the larger context around the decision making. I think that the collective, the concept of collective, how much you affect collective, was really beyond my life experience, having grown up in a much more individualistic way of thinking and cultural context. And I just think that the consciousness of thinking of the collective is so different and paradigm shifting for me. And that's a big one that I have a lot more sort of knowledge of and respect for now that I really didn't understand before.
No, and I think it's very unique because you were able to really experience Indian culture in a way that I don't think any expat really has been able to, because you've been able to immerse yourself in it day in, day out, interacting with these people who are your relatives or your husband or your in-laws. And then obviously going to get a unique perspective on that. Yeah, I mean, that was great. Thank you so much, Leah, for your insights.
Absolutely.
It was so much fun, as expected. And please stay safe, stay sane.
Thank you. You too.